Their spears was like stars on the sea when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. I slowly close my eyes. Don't you have anything better to do with your time than quote poetry at me? I ask, valiantly maintaining my cool as the phantom owner of that voice comes to stand behind me. I can feel him there, his presence like a raging inferno at my back.
I wouldn't call it grim.
I nearly jump out of my skin when something touches me. My hair, specifically. I see his hand out of the corner of my eye as he coils a length of my hair around his index finger, his nails still marked with the tiniest chip of black nail polish, rubbing the pad of his thumb lightly over the blonde strands. Fighting for an even breath, I remain very, very still. I lick my lips, my mouth too dry, and then I speak. For the angel of death spread his wings on the blast and breathed in the face of the foe as he passed, and the eyes of the sleepers waxed deadly and chill, and their hearts but once heaved and forever grew still. Ren lets the loop of hair he wound around his finger fall loose. He moves silently, walking around the desk so that he's no longer hovering behind me, but standing, brazen as you like, as if he doesn't care who sees us together, right freaking beside me.
So, you do have a favorite after all, he muses, looking down at me with curiosity kindling in his eyes.
I try not to look at him, but not looking at him is like not picking at a scab or not poking a wobbly tooth with your tongue. Impossible. Not really. I had to memorize that poem for a class last semester. I guess I haven't scrubbed it from my memory just yet. Byron's poems were too flowery for me. I don't like how they rhymed so obviously most of the time. Ren catches his bottom lip between his teeth, his eyes glowing in an amused way I've never seen before. He skirts the table and sits down opposite me, leaning across the polished wood.
You like poetry.
That's all he says, but it looks as though this revelation is the most amazing thing that's ever happened to him. That seat's taken, you know, I reply bleakly. Karina's gonna be back any second. If she sees you sitting here talking to me,
the whole world will implode and burn to ash, and the seas will dry, and meteors will strike the earth, obliterating all life as we know it.
She'll piece this together, whatever this is, and... He looks confused.
Whatever this is?
Oh, I forgot. Piece of shit playbook rule number 3. This is the part where you pretend like nothing happened between us last night, right? Ren smothers a dark grin by resting his chin in his hand, covering his mouth. His hair looks extra wild and unkempt today, which only makes me want to run my fingers through it even more than normal. He's wearing a thin black sweater with a tiny hole in one of the cuffs. I can't stop staring at that little hole as I wait for him to confirm my suspicion that he truly is a motherfucking asshole.
Is this the part where you judge me again and make assumptions about what I'm gonna do? He fires back.
God, I'm too tired for these kinds of games. I barely slept last night, and after jogging so far this morning, grinding myself into the ground before dawn even broke properly, I'm running on fumes. Rolling my eyes heavenward, I sag back into my hard-backed chair.
Is there something I can help you with, Ren?
My disloyal, double-crossing heart jackhammers away beneath my ribs as he stops smiling, pinning me with that rude green gaze. Normal people don't look at others the way Ren looks at me. It's as though he's searching for something in my face, and he won't blink or turn away until he's found it. It's extremely uncomfortable to be studied this way.
You can start by telling me what you meant by whatever this is.
Fuck, I don't know. I didn't mean anything by it. It was an off-the-cuff comment, okay? Don't worry, I'm not expecting you to declare me your girlfriend now.
He tips his head back and laughs. In the library, where silence is golden, he tips his beautiful fucking head back and he laughs.
A stern shh echoes across the room, and a horrible heat creeps up my neck. It was bad enough before, when only a few of the other students working at the desks had noticed Ren's arrival. Now everyone in the place knows that he's here, and that I just said something that he found patently ridiculous.
You might not have figured it out, but I know exactly what this is, Elodie, Ren says, his laughter dying on his lips. If you ever scrape up the courage and want to find out, all you need to do is ask. You know I'll be unfalteringly honest.
Oh, yeah, I can always rely on your unfaltering honesty. I wonder what the punishment would be for slapping another student. If we were in the art rooms, or Fitz's den, or the food hall, I might do it and find out, but not here. I wouldn't dare risk my library card. A ruinous smirk tugs at Ren's mouth. That wicked curve to his lips is absolutely torturous. When I see it, all I can think of is the heat of his mouth as he kissed me on that blanket. The smell of fresh pine and salt air and half-forgotten beaches in his hair as he dipped down to press that cruel mouth to my neck.
Is this the part where you tell me how excited you are to meet up tonight? He asks.
I ignore the question. Are you seriously going to risk Karina coming back here and seeing us together? He looks at me like I'm speaking in tongues, and nothing I'm jabbering about makes any sense.
I'm sorry, little E. I don't know what I did to encourage this belief that I give a flying fuck what Karina Mendoza thinks about anything, but let me clear this up. I don't care if Karina comes back and finds me sitting in this chair. I don't care if she knows that I want you. I don't care if she knows that I had my tongue down your throat last night and you made my dick harder than it's been in 2 fucking years.
Wow. I look down at my hands, my cheeks burning like crazy.
Oh, Elodie, Ren whispers breathlessly. You don't like hearing that? That you made my dick hard? Or do you like hearing it too much?
For God's sake, can you not say stuff like that in public, please? I despise myself for blushing. From the way he's staring at me, his lips parted, eyes wide, he's fascinated by my reaction to his outrageous statement. It would have been so much better for me if I'd kept my cool and not reacted at all. For some reason, it matters to me that he doesn't think I'm some stuttering, stupid, inexperienced schoolgirl. It shouldn't, but fuck, it really does. Ren slides his hand across the table, palm facing upwards, his fingers curled up toward the ceiling, his eyes fierce and intense.
You do know how crazy you drive me, don't you, little E? You know that my body isn't my own anymore. I fucking crave you. And I really don't give a fuck who knows it.
He looks down at his hand, resting between us on top of the lacquered table's surface. Clearly, this is some sort of test. He's waiting for me to reach out and take his hand. I have no idea what his end goal is here, but it feels like a trap, and if I put my hand in his, I'll be endangering myself. I follow his gaze, staring at the lines of his palm, tracing them with my eyes, wishing very badly that I could reach out and trace them with the tips of my fingers, to feel the heat and the roughness of his skin.
I know what you're thinking, he whispers.
Numb. I am so fucking numb. I can't feel anything bar my own churning fear. It's impossible not to feel that.
You do?
Ren's voice is as soft as silk, as hushed as snow falling in winter.
Yes, and I swear you're wrong. This isn't some bet between me and the other guys. I've pinned no wager on whether you care if I live or die. I'm not trying to make you feel something for me that you shouldn't, purely for my own entertainment.
But that's what you wanted, right? When I first got here, you decided you were going to target me as your next plaything. You wanted to hurt me, and you were going to smile while you did it. I saw it in your eyes.
And what do you see now?
I barely hear the words. They're so quiet. Fuck. Please do not look up at him, Elodie. Do not fucking do it. My breath stoppers up in my throat. It must have been stuck there for a while because my lungs are beginning to burn. I can't help myself. I do it. I look up at him, dead in the eye, and it's as though I've been shot in the chest. A cold, creeping sensation spreading outward from my solar plexus. His eyes are clear. I see no deception in them. I see plenty of pride and a whole heap of ego, but I also see the faintest, weakest glimmer of hope. I can't bear the pressure building between us a second longer. I look away, out of the window. Ren closes his hand into a fist, withdrawing it back across the table. Is this the part where you leave now? I ask morosely.
Yeah, this is the part where I leave.
He stands, running both his hands back through his hair, a gesture of pure frustration.
I came to tell you that I left something by your door for you, little E. I thought about going inside and putting it by your bed, but we both know how you feel about people breaking into your room, right?
He goes before I can say another word. God damn it. An invisible hand closes around my throat, choking the life out of me as I sit there, waiting for Karina to come back with our lunch. After a while, she shows up with a couple of sandwiches, two apples, and a giant bag of Doritos balanced in her arms. I let her chatter away, and I chew and swallow the food she so kindly brought back for me. But I'm not really here. I'm just waiting for an opportunity to bolt. The opportunity arrives when Karina's phone begins to buzz, and she holds up her cell, grinning like an idiot, and tells me that Andre's calling. I make my excuses and I leave her to go talk to her boyfriend. On the fourth floor, outside room 416, I find a small turquoise box with a pale green ribbon tied around it, sitting there, waiting for me. With shaking hands, I collect it from the floor and hurry inside, my insides twisting themselves into knots. He left me a gift? I place the box down on the bed, glaring at it with my hands on my hips. He should not have brought me a gift. It takes all of my courage to gingerly untie the ribbon and lift up the lid. Oh my God. I cover my mouth with my hands, trying not to cry out. My eyes sting as I take a step forward, bending over to get a closer look at the tiny little object nestled in amongst a bed of lilac tissue paper inside. The white of his chest that fades to the blue of his back, that deepens to the dark midnight blue at the tips of his wings. It's the bird, my mother's bird, the one that was shattered into a million pieces. And he's somehow been pieced back together.
20. Ren. A paradigm shift. That's what philosophers would call a change like this. Because I haven't simply changed my mind about something. I've had a change of heart. Ponder that for a second. A man's heart is his footlocker, where he keeps the key pieces of his identity. where his very purpose and the traits that make up his character reside, his hopes, his dreams, and his nightmares. And Elodie Stillwater has come along, taken a knife to my chest, and removed my heart. She's switched it out for another one entirely, and now I don't know where the fuck any of my shit is. I don't know who I am, or what I'm supposed to be doing. And quite honestly, the whole thing is a fucking mess. More than anything, I want it to be over. I get the feeling this isn't going to be over for a very long time, though, if ever. And now I find myself in a position where I feel obliged to do something very rash. That manila goddamn envelope. I tried to forget what I'd read, but the words are still there, burning brighter than the sun whenever I close my eyes. It's put me in the foulest fucking mood. I cut through the rose garden, grinding my teeth so hard that they'll probably be little more than dust by the time I reach the gazebo. The maze is both prison and sanctuary as I wind my way through the memorized pathway to its center, biting out curse words colorful enough to make steam blow out of my father's ears. Pax and Dash are already waiting for me when I arrive at the small building hidden beneath the oak trees. Sprawled out on the steps that lead up to the front door, Pax takes one look at me and starts howling like a wolf. "Dear God, Jacoby, you look even saltier than usual. I take it your little meeting with the French whore didn't go according to plan." With murder in my eyes, I turn and glower at Dash, who's leaning effortlessly against the wall, plucking the petals from an unopened rosebud. "What?" he asks, feigning innocence. "I had to tell him something. He wanted to know why you bailed on our Albany College plans last night. He'd been looking forward to that sorority party all month." "You could have gone without me," I snarl. "I wasn't stopping you." Dash pulls a pouty face. "I know, man, but for some ungodly reason, we both like having you around, and it really wouldn't have been the same if you weren't there to ruin everybody's fun. In the meantime, you're bailing on us for the second time in 24 hours to go and see the same girl. We're beginning to feel like you might be struggling a little with your priorities. Need I remind you that we've had your back for the past 4 years? We've lived together and gotten into a whole heap of shit together." He holds his hands up. "We've done so many drugs in so many countries that I have stamps in my passport I don't even recognize. I could have sworn I'd never been to Brazil. Anyway, the point is, we're gonna need you to rein this thing in a little, just for a while, yeah?" "Yeah, we need regular, normal, wicked Ren back this weekend." I narrow my eyes, already sensing that something bad's on the horizon. "Why, what's happening this weekend?" Pax scrambles up, dusting off his jeans. He jumps down the steps, boots thudding when they hit the dirt, and he throws his arm around my shoulder. "It," he pauses for dramatic effect, "is your birthday, you sneaky fuck. You really think we'd forget? We're having a last-minute Jacoby turns 18 party, and there's nothing you can say or do to stop it." Christ. I really had hoped they'd have forgotten about that. Chances are they would have. They're not very good at remembering important dates at the best of times, but then Mercy showed up, and my sister isn't one to let anyone forget her birthday. Unfortunately for me, we happen to share the same one. We're not having a party. "Yes, we fucking are." Pax nods like he's just parachuted a bunch of speed. "We're not having a party," I repeat. Dash crosses his arms in front of his chest. "Yeah, mate, we are. We're not. I need your help with something this weekend and it can't wait. I've already bought the tickets." The boys look intrigued. "What tickets?" Pax asks suspiciously. "Plane tickets. We need to leave the country for a couple of days, and you can't tell anyone where you're going or we'll all be fucked." Now I've got their attention. Really got it. They love a covert trip more than anything else in the world, including Riot House parties. "How long are we gonna be gone for?" Dashiell queries, pretending to scrutinize a loose thread hanging from the cuff of his shirt. 3 days. We leave tonight." "Wow. Well, someone's feeling presumptuous, aren't they? What if we don't want to go on this little jolly of yours? What if we don't want to miss 2 days of school? Then I'd have wasted $30,000, and you'd be the most confusing person in the world because who doesn't want to miss 2 days of school?
We haven't filled out the paperwork with Harcourt, Pax points out, taking a smoke out of a dog-eared pack and lighting it.
I took the liberty of completing it on your behalf this morning.
Asshole, Dash groans. You've thought of everything, haven't you?
Come on, Lovett. Wouldn't want to ruin my birthday now, would you?
That's a low fucking blow. At least it sounds like we're flying first class, Pax mumbles.
I grin. Nothing but the best for my boys.
God, don't you just hate it when he does that? It's fucking terrifying when you smile.
Dash's shoulders sag in resignation, though. He's coming with me on my little sojourn. And if Dash is in, then so is Pax. The guy in question rubs a hand over his shaved head.
Fine. We'll go where you command. No questions asked. But we are having a party when we get back, Ren. I get the feeling you're gonna owe us one after this, and there had better be fucking strippers.
Cosgrove's is a squat, ugly building on the outskirts of Mountain Lakes. A bar, managed by a short, balding guy called Patterson, who has the misfortune of looking like Danny DeVito. The guy's in his late 50s, has a penchant for polishing a glass at least 3 times before putting it back on a shelf, and does not like me in the slightest. Primarily because I'm underage and shouldn't be drinking in his bar, but also because I'm his boss. He complains murderously under his breath when he sees me walk through the door into the empty establishment, his beady, almost black eyes boring a hole into the countertop as he studiously ignores me.
We've been over this, I say, sitting myself down on a stool in front of him. Pretending I don't exist won't make me go away. It'll make me mad.
Madder, I say, correcting myself.
And I'm sure neither of us want to be dealing with that today.
Shouldn't you go lurk out the back?
Patterson grumbles.
Sheriff King likes to come in here drinking on a Saturday afternoon.
No, he doesn't.
He might. Wouldn't want to risk getting this place shut down now, would you?
I laugh, theatrically pointing out the sea of empty seats that surround me. Hell, Pat, wouldn't want to jeopardize the roaring trade we've been doing of late. It'll make zero difference to me if this place closes its doors to the public. It didn't make money before I bought it, and it hasn't made a dime since either. You should be grateful I keep you gainfully employed on the off chance that I might want to get out of the house. Patterson's mouth twists to one side. He opens up the register and begins to count the money inside it, shuffling through rumpled bills and the same coins I'm sure have been sitting inside it since the dawn of fucking time.
I need more money for the float, he says.
I squint at him, laying my hands flat on the bar. The wood's splintered, the varnish worn off years ago. I should do something about the general state of disrepair in here, but Cosgrove's is a dive bar. The cracks in the walls, and the fact that you run the gambit of getting a splinter whenever you order a drink, well, that's all just part of the charm of the place. You do get how a float works, right? It's there to make change for paying customers, not for you to dip into every time you want to buy a pack of smokes. Patterson just glares at me. Mountain Lakes isn't a thriving town. Used to be a logging town before the surrounding forests were designated national parkland. Now the only real industry here is the pulp mill, 3 miles beyond the town limits. And Wolf Hall, of course. The people who don't work at the mill, or tend the gardens, cook in the kitchens, or clean the hallways at the academy, work odd jobs or in the stores along the main street to get by. It'd be fucking easy to replace Patterson. I could have someone else here grateful of the job inside half a fucking hour, and the grumpy old bastard knows it. Like I said, though, the tumble-down, broken, worn patina of the place was a selling point when I decided to buy the bar, and Patterson's curmudgeonly snark was a part of that, too.
$40 should do it, he says flatly.
I pull $100 bill out of my wallet and flick it across the bar at him.
I want a shot of whiskey in front of me in the next 30 seconds, asshole, and I swear to God if you try and pour that lighter fluid from the rail for me again, I will end your sorry existence.
He pockets the 100 instead of putting it into the till, which I say nothing about because at this stage in the proceedings, I find his open belligerence entertaining more than anything. He steps up onto the wooden box he keeps behind the counter and takes down the bottle of Johnny Blue from the highest shelf Cosgrove's has. Instead of pouring me a 50-mil pour in a shot glass, Patterson flips over a rocks glass and free pours four fingers of the burnt golden liquid into it, smiling sarcastically. And yes, the man has perfected the art of the sarcastic smile. He's one of only a few people I've ever seen accomplish the task. I lift the glass to my mouth, eyeing the $120 worth of whiskey he just so artlessly dumped into it, and I smile my most savage smile. You really are a fucker, aren't you, Pat? The whiskey leaves a trail of fire all the way down my esophagus, but it's a smooth burn, one that glows rather than bites. I manfully swallow down the rest of the whiskey, polishing the lot off in two mouthfuls, and then slam the glass down on the woodwork. Having a hard time up there on the mountain? The bartender asks, without the faintest hint of sincerity in his voice. They run out of foie gras? Has the champagne stopped flowing out of the faucets? Fuck you, man. I can imagine how difficult it must get for you poor kids up there, having to brush your own teeth and wipe your own asses. Must be pure torture. They really ought to hire some extra serfs to cater to our little princeling's more intimate needs. If you don't quit with the vitriol, I'll lock you in the beer cellar again. That shuts him up, because he knows I'll do it. I've done it before. I think Patterson enjoys our verbal and occasionally physical sparring almost as much as I do. He doesn't like it when I kick his rotund ass down the stairs that lead into the basement, and I lock him down there for the afternoon, though. He flashes teeth. Where are those friends of yours, the English toff and the addict? What makes you think Pax is an addict? He looks like that guy out of that movie with the Scottish junkies. I don't think you can accuse someone of being a drug addict because they have a shaved head and they bear a passing resemblance to a young Ewan McGregor. He grunts, clearly of a different mind. You want more? He thrusts the Johnny Walker at me. It's the middle of the afternoon, man. Despite what you might think of me, I'm not a degenerate. Laughable. The lie is just so fucking laughable that even I grin like a piece of shit when Patterson holds his belly and roars. The things he's seen me do. The states he's seen me in, Jesus. I have a question for you, Pat, I say, leaning forward so that the edge of the bar digs into my ribs. You're a married man, aren't you? If Pat had any eyebrows, they'd be up around his receding hairline right now. Yeah? That big lady with the mustache, the one who cleans the toilets, she's your actual wife? His eyes, already so set back into his face, practically disappear as he glowers at me. Are you looking for a smack boy? No offense meant. Oh, well, in that case, none taken. There he goes with that sarcasm again. He's a fucking pro. I just mean, how long have you been married to the lovely Mrs. Patterson? I ask, changing tack. 17 years. Shit. How the hell did you do it? Do what? How did you convince her that you weren't an evil, heartless piece of shit in the first place? Patterson rocks back and forth on the balls of his feet, chuckling merrily to himself. This time he doesn't seem to be mocking me with his laughter. He seems genuinely amused. Oh, Lord, Ren. God, you crack me up sometimes. I'm being serious. So am I. Oh, God. Gathering himself, he plants his meaty hands on the other side of the bar, bracing himself like he's preparing to lay some serious wisdom on me. The key to convincing a woman that you're not an evil, heartless piece of shit, Ren, is to not be an evil, heartless piece of shit. Well, I can see that I walked myself right into that one. Even so, a lick of fury rises up my back, tingling between my shoulder blades. It's in my nature to want to punish the guy for such insolence, but now there's this nagging voice in the back of my head, asking how I would be acting if Elodie were here, and I don't even know what to do with myself anymore. Duly noted, I say tightly through my teeth. I never thought I'd see the day, Patterson caws.
You pompous, Wolf Hall asses come in here reeking of privilege. You play at participating in society like normal folk, but you're so like those fancy, expensive cars you all drive. Too low to the ground, no room for more than one person inside. The moment you hit a bump in the road or you're asked to think about carrying even the slightest burden, you're bottoming out and struggling to carry anything at all.
Your metaphor is falling apart, Pat.
Doesn't matter. Look, heaven help whoever this girl is if you're interested in her, but this shit is simple. Don't be selfish. Don't be a dick. Put her needs before your own. Jesus, what the fuck am I?
He shakes his head.
Why am I even bothering?
I leave Cosgrove's feeling even more confused than when I went in. It all seems straightforward, and I know that Patterson's speaking the truth. In order to get Elodie to trust me, I need to make a few changes. But for the life of me, I can't figure out how the fuck I'm going to alter my very genetic coat. What the fuck? I stop dead on the sidewalk, the wind whipping at me, tugging on my clothes, but I barely notice the cold. I can't be seeing clearly. There's just no fucking way. Across the other side of the street, in a deserted parking lot on the other side of high chain-link fence, two people stand at arm's distance, talking animatedly. The tall guy on the left gesticulates, using his hands to make his point. The girl, much shorter, dressed like she's about to clock on for her shift at a strip joint, a sheet of black hair hanging down her back, laughs, shoving him playfully in the chest. I'm crossing the street before I even know what I'm doing. There's no entrance to the parking lot from this side of the road. It must be on the other side of the lot, but that doesn't stop me. In one jump, I'm halfway up the fence. A second after that, I'm vaulting over the top of it, jumping down, landing on the ground with a bone-jarring rattle that makes it through my ankles, knees, hips, back, and ends with my teeth crashing together so hard that I nearly bite off my fucking tongue. They see me, but only when it's too late. My fist launches into Fitz's jaw, connecting with an almighty, satisfying crack. It goes down like a sack of shit.
What the fuck?
My sister's shrill scream is loud and high-pitched. I grab her by the arm and pull her out of the way.
Get the fuck off me, Ren. Christ! What's wrong with you, you fucking psycho?
On the ground, Fitz presses his fingers to his mouth, laughing like a maniac when they come away red. His blood coats his teeth and runs down his chin.
Nice to see you too, Jacoby.
Are you invincible, Doc? I snarl, grabbing him by the front of his t-shirt. Have you discovered the secret to eternal life? He arches a sardonic eyebrow. Not a flicker of fear in his eyes, not a scrap of concern on him. He glances down at my mouth, his eyes lingering on my lips, and I just know he's getting fucking hard right now. No, he says. Are you indestructible? Are your bones unbreakable? Do your wounds close immediately and stop you from bleeding out? No, Ren, as well you know, they do not. He enunciates every single word, purring like a cat. Alive with rage, I shove him hard enough that the back of his head bounces off the concrete. Then stop doing shit that's gonna wind up getting you killed, motherfucker.
What the hell are you thinking?
Mercy's in front of me now, her hands on my chest, pushing me, pushing, 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 forcing me to take a small step away from the English teacher.
We're in fucking public, Ren. Are you insane? You can't fucking hit a member of faculty in front of people.
As menacing as can be, I dip down so I can shove my face in hers. I'll hit him anywhere I like. Go and get in the car, Mercy.
I'm not getting in any car with you. Get in the fucking car.
I'm vibrating, overflowing, spilling over, pure and blinding rage. It takes chunks out of my insides with every ragged breath I suck down. Mercy's expression voids out, turning blank. She blinks, then turns around and begins to walk across the parking lot towards the red Volkswagen Beetle our father bought for her last year.
I don't see the harm in talking to a student if I see them out in the wild, Fitz says airily, propping himself up on one hand. What am I supposed to do? Ignore you guys?
Oh, my God. This motherfucker right here. Slowly, I crouch down in front of him, resting my forearms on top of my thighs, observing him with utter contempt. You don't look at anything that belongs to me. You don't touch anything that belongs to me. Outside of your remit as a teacher, you don't speak to anybody that's connected with me. Do you understand? With eyes full of heat, Fitz sucks on his bottom lip, both nostrils flaring. It doesn't have to be like this, you know. Things could be like they were before. Fuck, he just doesn't listen. I close my eyes, shaking my head, unable to believe the gall of the bastard. Just keep your word, Wes, or life's gonna become really unpleasant for you, yeah? I get into Mercy's stupid, girly red Beetle, slamming my fist into the dashboard so hard that the plastic cracks. Ren, you asshole, what the fuck are you doing? Mercy hits me, landing a blow to my upper arm. She's always been far more interested in being skinny than fit, so she doesn't pack much power, won't even bruise. Just because you've already broken all of your stuff doesn't make it okay to break mine, she pouts. I feel like I've just run a marathon. I can't catch my breath. Grow up, Mercy. You don't think he's gonna report you to Harcourt now? She hisses, her eyes flashing daggers at me. You think he's just gonna keep his mouth shut if you knock him on his ass in the middle of town? You humiliated him. Yeah, I fucking humiliated him. But there won't be any recourse for my actions in this parking lot, and Mercy knows it. I know it, and Wesley Fitzpatrick knows it most of all. He isn't gonna say shit. His problem has always been that he wants me to hurt him, to humiliate him. Almost as badly as he wants me to fuck him. When we get back to the school, I pull over at the side of the road by Riot House and I get out of the car. Mercy switches places with me. You're fucking insane, she yells as she burns off up the hill toward the academy. If she expects this to be some sort of revelation to me, then she's shit out of luck. What I'm about to do is proof enough that she's right. I take out my phone and I type out a quick message before heading inside to throw some clothes into a bag. Me. Going away for 3 days. Catch you when I get back.
21. Elodie. There are cracks everywhere, of course, and a few spots where the color of his wings is gone, replaced by smooth white ceramic, where a chip or a shard of his original veneer was lost. But the bird my mother gave me is mostly whole again. And of all the people in the world, Ren Jacoby put him back together for me. For me. I have questions. Namely, where did he find all of the pieces? How did he retrieve them? Harcourt said they were vacuumed up and disposed of. Did he tear open the vacuum cleaner to get them out? And how the hell did he piece the figurine back together? It would have taken hours. Days. I can't even comprehend how much time it must have taken. How much patience such an undertaking would have required. Far more patience than I credited Ren with possessing, that's for sure. It doesn't take long for an uncomfortable suspicion to take root in my mind. Like a weed pushing its way up through the cracks in a pavement. Ren didn't put the bird back together. He just couldn't have. In no reality would he have taken the time to do something that required that much effort. Which means that he forced, bribed, or threatened someone else and made them do it. And then he dropped his little turquoise box off at my door, smug as fuck, pretending like he's some kind of hero for returning something so precious to me. I go from grateful and amazed to jaded and disappointed in 3 seconds flat. It's the only explanation that makes any sense. At 6 in the evening, I get a message from Ren saying that he's going away for 3 days. His short, catch you when I get back. Makes me so unreasonably angry that I lock myself in my room and I don't come out until Sunday afternoon. What happened to the attic? 3 days getting to know him? My ass. I've expected this kind of behavior from him since the word go. So then why does it still sting? I skip dinner, telling Karina I'm not hungry when she asks if I want to join her in the food hall. And I brood in my room, pacing up and down, wearing a trench in the floorboards as I whip back and forth like a lion in a cage, all the while staring at the bird like it's a hand grenade about to go off on my mattress. How can he do something like this and then just bail? It makes no sense. Monday and Tuesday scrape by, and every little thing gets on my nerves. The line in the cafeteria, Damiana's snarky, relentless comments in English, the fact that there's no creamer left for my coffee, my assignments, which have piled up to the point that I have to stay up all night on Tuesday to complete them. Karina notices my shitty mood and comments on it. But I tell her I'm PMSing, and she seems to take it all in stride. Inside, I'm boiling away like a pot left on the heat. It shouldn't bother me that he just left without explaining himself. I shouldn't care at all that I find out it was Mercy's birthday over the weekend, which means it was Ren's birthday, and he went off with his friends to celebrate. But it affects me. All of it does. God, what kind of fragile, pathetic kind of loser have I become? When Ren doesn't show up for class on Wednesday, I've become so irritated by the whole thing that I decide I need to do something about the situation. For the sake of my own sanity, if not for poor Karina's. Underneath all of the frustration and anger lies the sickening worry that I hurt Ren when I didn't take his hand in the library. He could be pissed that I didn't immediately drop to my knees in gratitude when he told me that he cared about me. I'm sure that's what he was expecting me to do. If he's salty because of some perceived rejection on my part, then maybe that'll be it. He'll leave me alone, and I won't have to deal with his attentions anymore. This thought should make me happy. I've been frustrated by him for weeks, and with him backing off, I'll be able to settle into life at Wolf Hall properly now, without fear of further complications. But, Erg, why is there always a fucking but? Why can't I just do a celebratory dance and move the fuck on like any sane person would do? I sit in the dark of my room, stewing. I scarf down half a bar of chocolate, but the sugar tastes sour and the candy curdles in my stomach, making me nauseous. I do whatever I can to take my mind off the fact that Ren still hasn't messaged me, frittering away an hour playing Animal Farm on my Nintendo Switch, then chatting with Levi on WhatsApp. But I still can't shake the disagreeable funk that has me in its grasps. The clock on my cell phone finally clicks over to 10 p.m., and I tell myself I should go to bed, but fuck, what the hell is wrong with me? Why can't I just forget about this entire thing? This is for the best. I should text him. I should ask him what the fuck he's playing at, sending me the most confusing mixed messages. I mean, what is he hoping to accomplish here? I've wound myself up so tightly that I feel like I'm going to snap by the time I grab my Doc Martens from the bottom of the closet, jamming them angrily onto my feet. A text message isn't good enough. I need an explanation from him, face to face. I need to know if he did force someone else to fix the bird for me. And loath as I am to admit it, I want to know if I actually hurt him by rebuffing him in the library. You're such a fool, Elodie. He's not worth your energy. Seriously, take your shoes off, get into bed, lose yourself in a good book, and forget about Ren Jacoby. He's a manipulative creep and nothing more. Instead, I pick up the book he loaned me, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's A Study in Scarlet, and I jam it into my bag. You're better than this, better than him. You don't damn well need him. The pep talk's a good one. I repeat it in my head as I try to tiptoe down the hallway. It's on a playback, cycling over and over again as I sneak my way down the stairs. I hear it again and again as I slip out of the academy, and I begin to run down the long driveway headed down the mountain. I didn't have a car in Tel Aviv. I didn't need one. A vehicle would be really handy here in New Hampshire, though, especially since I live in the middle of bumfuck nowhere. Karina offered to lend me the Firebird and said I could use it whenever I wanted, but I couldn't ask her for the keys tonight. She'd have wanted to know where I was going, and no way could I have told her the truth. Oh, you know, just thought I'd pop down to Riot House, after hours, alone, to discuss my non-starter, bizarre relationship/rivalry with the boy that you've warned me until you're blue in the face to stay away from. Yeah, that wasn't going to happen. So here I am, jogging down the hill, jumping out of my skin at every sound I hear, just waiting for something nasty with sharp teeth to come lurching out of the forest. I haven't seen a single car since I snuck out of the academy, and with no streetlights anywhere on the windy hairpin road, I only have the small flashlight on my cell phone to ward off the darkness. I knew this was a horrible idea before I left Wolf Hall, but it's only hitting home now just how horrible an idea it was. If anything happens to me, I'd better just die and get it over with. If I don't, Karina's gonna murder me, and I'd rather get eaten by a bear or buried in a shallow grave by the Riot House boys than have to see the look of disappointment in her eyes when she puts me down. Eventually, I reach the narrow dirt track that branches off from the main road leading to Ren's house, and panic closes around my heart like a fist. I can't see any lights. There are no lights coming from inside the house. There's no one home. Which means I've come all this way in the dark for nothing, and Ren's still not back from his party weekend with the boys, and he's out there somewhere, having a great time, having completely forgotten my existence. Just fucking great. Oh, wow. The realization hits me like a bucket of ice-cold water's just been dumped over my head. This is not the kind of person I want to be. Some stupid girl wandering off on her own in the dark, all bent out of shape because of some boy who can't seem to make up his mind about her. I have more common sense than that, more self-respect. Clenching my hands into fists, I stare off into the night, my decision made. I'm going back to the academy. I'm not falling prey to this kind of insanity. Before I can start the long walk back to Wolf Hall, a light suddenly comes on up ahead, casting a yellow glow out into the darkness. Riot House rises up out of the ink-black forest, appearing out of nowhere, and my frantic heart rate slows. So, they are home after all. A part of me is relieved by that knowledge, but the rest of me is frustrated that I'd even let myself kick. A steel bar wraps around my neck, cutting off my air supply. "Scream and you're fucking dead," a vicious growl warns. What the fuck? For a second, I am fear personified. My mind just blanks. I can't breathe, can't move, can't think. The impossibly strong band around my throat tightens. "Little snake," the voice hisses, "tiptoeing around in the dark, spying on people. Very bad, petit bout français. Very bad indeed." The blockade that slammed up inside of me shatters, falling apart. That phrase, the little French whore, that's what Pax called me when I walked into my very first class at the academy. I have no doubt that it's him standing behind me, trapping me in a chokehold. And with that knowledge, my fear evaporates. He's not a monster. He's not some supernatural creature prowling out of the woods looking for his next meal. He's just a guy with an attitude problem, and I've been trained how to deal with those. I slam my elbow back and up into his ribs. He's so much taller than me that he's had to bend himself over to grab me, which means I can get a lot of momentum behind the blow. Pax huffs out a surprised breath, winded, and I use the opportunity to my advantage. Twisting, spinning in his arms, I jam my knuckles into his throat, slamming them into his Adam's apple, and his hold on me disappears.
"Fucking bitch," he roars. "Come here. Get your ass here right fucking now."
He blinks, shocked, when I obey him without a second thought.
"Sure, I'll come to you, motherfucker. I'll be right with you."
He exposes his teeth, anger burning brightly in his eyes, and makes a grab for me. I have him by the wrist, though. I yank his arm around, slamming my palm against his elbow, forcing the joint to bend the wrong way. And Pax reacts the same way all the big boys do when they're about to get their arm broken. He drops to his knees, crying out in pain. From there, it's easy enough. I release his arm, but I'm not done with him just yet. The sole of my Doc Marten lands between his shoulders when I kick out, putting all my strength behind the blow. He topples forward into the leaf litter, cursing furiously. And then I'm on his back, anticipating what he'll do next, already waiting for him to try and twist around underneath me. My fists raised, wound back as far as it can go, ready to break his fucking nose and end his pretty boy modeling career for good when...
"I don't think that'll be necessary," a polite voice informs me.
A hand closes around my wrist, tight enough that I can't wrench it free. Pax jackknifes, bucking me off his back, and I fly sideways onto the ground. Dash stands over me, his face a blank mask, his expression utterly unreadable. With only the dim light from the house spilling over his features, he looks like a statue of a man. An inanimate carving left out for the elements to claim.
"Crazy little fucker,"
Pax pants, whirling around to face me. He's about to lunge down and grab hold of me again when a third figure materializes out of the shadows. Like a pale wraith, Ren stands over me with his hands hidden in his pockets, dark hair obscuring half his face. His crooked smile looks more than a little wolfish.
"Well, boys, better break out the good china," he rumbles. "Looks like we have ourselves an unexpected house guest."
22. Elodie. The coffee is bitter and warm and sends a shiver of pleasure running down my spine. Dash sits on the very edge of the leather sofa, watching me drink from the cup with a level of fascination that makes it seem like he just woke from a 3,000-year coma and he has no idea what coffee is. Or mugs, or sofas, or girls who know Krav Maga.
"That really was quite impressive," he says, resting his chin in his hand.
"No, it was fucking dumb," Pax snaps, massaging his throat.
"She knew I was fucking around. She cranked that shit up to 11 for no reason."
He's sitting on the floor, leaning up against the wall by the open fire, glaring balefully at me while he tends to his bruised windpipe. I barely fucking touched him. Ren hasn't said much. He stands by the doorway that leads through to the kitchen, his shoulders tensed as he watches his two friends. His jade eyes have skimmed over me once or twice, but his main focus has been on Dash and Pax, as if he's waiting for something to happen. He's wearing a black hoodie and some loose sweatpants, and boy, does he make them look sinful. The son of a bitch could make a garbage bag look good, though. I look away from him, only to catch Dash frowning deeply at me.
"What brings you over, love? We adore receiving people, but the place is kind of a bomb site. It's past midnight and we just got back from a very long trip. We were about to start some party planning."
The house is spotless. The thick cream rug that Pax's annoying ass is sprawled out on looks recently vacuumed. The glass coffee table doesn't have a single fingerprint on it. The beaten brass panel above the fireplace is so polished, it's as reflective as a mirror. The moody paintings on the walls, black, blue, white, slashes of emotion on canvas, are much more breathtaking now that I'm seeing them properly lit and don't have a fleck of dust gathering on their frames. The magazines and books on top of the sideboard are so perfectly aligned that not a rogue corner or dog-eared edge pokes out from their stacks. The place looks like a fucking hotel lobby. Ren coughs into his balled-up fist, apparently trying to muffle his snort of laughter. The corner of his eyes are crinkled, betraying his amusement, though. I never thought it possible for him to smile, but it actually happens pretty frequently. You just have to be paying attention in order to catch it. I catch something else as he holds that hand in front of his face. His knuckles are bruised. One of them is split open, red and raw. They weren't like that the other night in the attic, nor in the library either. I would have noticed. He's hit something since I saw him on Saturday. And by the looks of things, he hit that something hard. As if he can feel my gaze on him, Ren unclenches his fist, stretching his fingers out, and lazily shoves his hand back into the pocket of his sweatpants, looking down at his feet. Sorry for interrupting your party planning, I say in a droll tone. I just came to return a book I borrowed from Ren. I pull A Study in Scarlet out of my bag, holding it sheepishly in the air, as if showing them the book will inexplicably make my excuse less lame. Ren looks up at me from under dark, banked brows, giving me all of his attention at least. He looks pained, though. His mouth twitches, slanting up at the side. Ah, Sherlock Holmes. Yeah, I wondered where that had gotten to. God, you're pathetic, Pax laughs. He rips the sock off his right foot, balls it up, and hurls it at Ren's face. A girl skipped down the hill in the dark by herself, and you're standing over there all, oh, Sherlock Holmes, my favorite book of all time. Credit us with a little common sense. She came here to get some dick, Jacoby. Dash laughs down his nose, but manages to cut it off pretty quickly. He studiously stares up at the ceiling, looking anywhere and everywhere but at me. The only person who actually does look at me is Ren. He must see the bright red stains on both my cheeks. My embarrassment can probably be seen from outer space. Ducking my head, I crack my neck, letting out a steady, even breath. What does it matter if that's what they think? Who fucking cares anyway? They're a pair of jackals, these two. Equally detestable for a variety of reasons. I won't be cowed by their stupid, inane comments or their adolescent tittering. Slowly, I get to my feet, still holding the coffee mug and the book in my hands. Whatever, I'm gonna go up to your room, Ren. I'll give you a beat to figure out those party planning duties. No rush. The three of them just stare at me as I waltz across the open-plan living room area and I begin to climb the stairs. My heart slams like a jackhammer, my pulse roaring, but I don't falter. I hold the mug steady in my hands. I put one foot in front of the other, cool and even, a picture of calm. Until I reach the second floor landing and they can no longer see me, that is. My hand shakes so violently that the coffee in the mug sloshes over the side, splattering to the polished floorboards. Thankfully, the liquid misses the plush gray carpet runner, but I've still made one hell of a mess. Fuck, fuck, fuck. Quickly shrugging out of my zip-up hoodie, I drop it to the ground, stepping on it and using my foot to mop up the coffee, shaking all over now. What the fuck did I just do? In front of Dashiell and Pax? And Ren? What the fuck? I'm gonna go up to your room? I'm gonna go up to your room? Oh my God, I barely know the guy. Sweet baby Jesus, why couldn't I have just sent him a shitty text message for ghosting me and stayed in my fucking room? Lord knows how I make it up the second flight of stairs, or the third, but I do. My legs are unsteady, barely holding me up as I open the door to Ren's room and go inside, hurriedly closing it behind me. Well, this could not have gone any worse. I should have made a plan. I mean, even if they hadn't found me stalking about outside the house like a fucking psychopath, what was I gonna do? Just walk up to the front door and just fucking knock? Like that would have been a sane thing to do? I toss the book on the bed, and then I discard the half-empty mug of coffee on a shelf by the door, no longer needing the prop to make myself look normal, definitely not needing the caffeine. I'm already jittery enough, thank you very much. And I turn around, leaning back against the wall, closing my eyes for a second. Breathe, Elodie. Just breathe. In and out. In and out. Everything's okay. This is a totally salvageable situation. It isn't, though, and breathing makes things worse. The bedroom smells so acutely of Ren. All salt sea air and fresh wood shavings and the faintest hint of citrus. That my slowing heart rate ratchets up all over again. The pounding, 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 threatening to blow out my eardrums. Calm down, Elodie. Calm down. Name five things you can see. Come on, five things you can see. You can do this. Just calm the fuck down. I lock onto the first thing I lay eyes on, a tattered notebook sitting on top of Ren's bed. Even from the door, I can see the scribbles of black ink all over the lined paper. It looks like some kind of journal. The second thing I see, a canvas set up on an easel in the corner of the room, right by the floor-to-ceiling windows. There's a sheet on the floor underneath the easel, splattered with paint. A pot full of brushes sits on Ren's desk not far away, their bristled ends sticking out of the glass jar, their wooden handles flecked with even more paint. On the canvas itself, I walk over to it, my heart finally calming a little as I take in what I'm seeing. Black and moody, midnight blue and gray and white. I remember thinking to myself when I broke into Riot House with Karina that the paintings downstairs all looked like raging, angry storms. They had no point of focus or subject, but I could feel the unrest radiating off of them, even in the dark. This painting is a far cry from those pieces of art hanging on the walls on the first floor. There most definitely is a subject to this painting, and that subject is me. Broad, flat, sweeping brushstrokes make up the lines of my torso and my shoulders, but the details of my neck and my face are finer and more delicate. Half of the painting looks like it was done quickly, angrily, with resentful slashes, while the other half appears as though great care and effort was taken to carefully stroke in each minute detail. I'm not smiling in the painting. I'm sitting on a couch, the floral print of the fabric smeared and blurred out of focus behind me. The jumble and confusion of shapes and patterns directly behind my head tells me where I am. Sitting beneath the print of Gustav Klimt's The Kiss that hangs in Dr. Fitzpatrick's den. I'm looking off to one side, the line of my jaw hard like I'm clenching it, and there's a detached, aggressive light in my eyes that makes me look hard too, fierce.
I liked you best when you were angry, in the beginning, Ren says.
He stands in the doorway with his arms loosely folded across his chest, watching me with another of his unreadable, unfathomable expressions on his face.
I don't know anymore, though. Now I like seeing you smile, but it's hard to paint you like that.
Why? The word comes out as a whisper, a single rush of air past my lips.
Because you've never smiled at me, little E. I could steal those moments when you looked angry, when you weren't looking, because they were familiar. I'd already earned the anger and the hate you wore. But when you laugh with Karina,
or you smile at someone you don't even fucking know as they pass you in a hallway. He shakes his head.